This is Radio Times. I'm Jeff Brady, filling in for Marty Moscowain. We're going to spend this hour asking some big questions about how the universe works. Why is the sky dark at night? What is a black hole? And is it really possible to build a time machine? We have in studio Dave Goldberg. He teaches in the physics department at Drexel University. His book, The Universe in the Rearview Mirror, is out in paperback. And he writes the Ask a Physicist column at io9.com. Dave Goldberg, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you so much for having me.
For those of us who haven't seen the inside of a classroom for a while, I count myself among them, let's just start with a brief description from you. Remind us, what is physics?
No small feat. So physics is the science of, I tell my students, the science of predicting the future. We try to figure out as few rules as possible and to explain as broad a series of events as we possibly can in as great a detail as we possibly can. And then to do that, there's an awful lot of math involved. So the godfather, of course, is Isaac Newton, who started us off with his classic three laws of motion and explaining how gravity works. And these days we start talking about fundamental forces and general relativity and get very speculative and start talking about things like wormholes and parallel universes. So everything in between.
Very, very complicated, but essentially sort of the science of how things work in the world, right?
Absolutely.
Okay. And I'm gonna let you know what you're dealing with here, because math and science were difficult for me. And when I was in school and college, I actually signed up for a calculus class, showed up on the first day, they demonstrated, just showed us the calculator that we needed to buy for the class, and I dropped it. So,
can I let you in on a secret?
Okay.
I do not know how to work one of those fancy calculators. I hope that does not discredit me with our listeners.
Okay, so we're going to have a discussion here that everybody can relate to, and we hope that you'll be able to join us at some point. Have you ever had a question, something you've always wondered about how the universe works? Give us a call. The number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also email us, radiotimes@why.org. And on Twitter, the handle is @WHYYRadioTimes. All right. In the introduction of your book, you quote a physicist, Phil Anderson, who said that it's only slightly overstating the case to say that physics is the study of symmetry. Explain that a little bit.
Sure. So let me actually back up a step, if you don't mind.
Sure.
One of the things that I hear a lot, and I hear from well-educated radio interviewers, I hear from people on the street, I hear even with confessions from my own wife, is that, you know, they were turned off from some of the classes that they had in high school or in college in physics, because when they got in there, it was basically all equations. Mm-hmm. And there was, you know, math after math after math, and it wasn't clear where it came from. The physics itself seemed to be memorization and chugging through math. And that isn't really what physics is. So much of it, as I mentioned earlier, is trying to figure out how the world works in as few rules as possible. And so what Anderson and others have sort of recognized over time is that to really understand how the world works, you don't start with F equals MA or any of the other dozens of equations that you might have to memorize. You start with some basic idea of how the world works. And I'll give you a couple of simple examples just to sort of get us rolling. And some of them are going to sound really, really trivial. So, for example, one thing that seems to be true about our universe is that the laws of physics seem to be the same everywhere in space, and they seem to be the same at all times in the universe. A magnet will point in a different direction on Earth than it will in space, but that's only a local effect. That's nothing to do with how the universe really works. Presumably, magnetism, what controls the compass, the laws of that are the same here as they are anywhere else, and every experiment that we've ever done shows that that's the case. These are symmetries. The laws of physics are the same everywhere. The laws of physics are the same at all times. The laws of physics are the same in all directions. There's even other symmetries that say things like, if you take the entire universe and you looked at everything in a mirror, that all the events that transpired in the mirror universe would look as physically valid as they do normally. And that makes sense. Like, you go to a restaurant and you see a window, a mirror window, and the people on the other side of that look like they're having a perfectly reasonable dinner. And the only difference is the menus are printed the wrong way. Those are all symmetries. What Anderson and others have sort of realized is that when you start looking in detail, there are enormous implications to those. So one of the heroes of my book, probably the hero of my book, is a figure named Emmy Noether, who was this mathematician in the early 20th century. And one of the things she showed was all of these symmetries that you might just think are peculiar, interesting, maybe not so interesting, turn out to have really, really profound implications. And I'll give you one example. I mentioned that the laws of physics don't change in time. And by the way, when I say the laws of physics, I mean all the laws of nature, so everything that is. Physicists are a little self-centered that way. Laws of physics and the laws of everything we use interchangeably. It turns out that she showed that immediately leads to what's known as the conservation of energy, that energy can either be created or destroyed. Now, this was an old idea, that energy can either be created or destroyed, but that was seen as something that was a first principle. It was called the first law of thermodynamics, and it didn't seem like it could come from anything more basic. But Noether showed, no, it's just a consequence of the fact that the laws of physics don't change in time. Another case, the laws of physics are the same everywhere. Well, that's just a matter of, that demonstrates something called conservation of momentum. I don't want to give you equations here, but there is something that may sound a little familiar. Conservation of momentum is basically a statement of objects in motion stay in motion, objects in rest stay at rest. That was Newton, and it was Newton's first law of motion. And Noether said, no, that's not just fundamental. That comes from something. It comes from the fact that the laws of physics are the same everywhere. And on and on. Once you start with these very simple assumptions about how the universe works in terms of what can you do to it and everything stays the same, that is the definition of a symmetry, you immediately come to like these incredibly profound implications about how the world works. And if you're facile enough with it, you can basically derive all this amazing stuff that you had to be told, that previous generations would have had to been told, but we can actually work it out.
I want to talk a little bit more about Emmy Noether in a minute, but I want to really nail down this idea of symmetry. And one example that was in the introduction of your book, the universe in the rearview mirror, you said that when you're on a roller coaster and you get that feeling of being pushed into your seat, and that's at one point on the ride, it can be gravity causing that feeling. Another point, it can be the acceleration of the car that you're riding in. And so your body experiences the two as the same, but they're different. So somewhere in that is symmetry, that you can learn something about how the physical world works. That's what kind of brought it home for me.
So yeah, so there's, I mean, it actually, they are very intimately related. So if you're on a roller, there's, obviously, as long as your roller coaster is on the Earth, and I'm going to assume that it is, the gravity of the Earth is always working on you. But at the bottom of a curve, you're going to be pushed into your seat, and at the top of a curve, you're going to be sort of pulled into your seat. You're going to feel lighter than normal, and those two effects feel the same. Whether you're pushed into your seat extra, or if you were just on a planet with a little extra gravity, it doesn't feel very different. It turns out that they aren't different. They aren't different with any sort of experiment that you can do. This was something that was put forward by Einstein in 1915. It is known as the equivalence principle. And the idea is, if I came into your... I'm not threatening this. I just want to make sure because we're on the radio. But if I came into your room late at night and knocked you out, and you woke up in a room with no doors or windows and just a lot of physics equipment, but it felt like Earth gravity normal, you couldn't tell. There's nothing you could do inside your little elevator to tell whether you were in an ordinary box here sitting on the surface of the Earth, or whether I'd thrown you into deep space and there was a rocket just accelerating you in such a way that you were pushed down to the bottom of the room. Those two things feel the same. And what Einstein showed is that in a very real sense, they are the same. and that every experiment you can do will produce the same results, and that starting from that point, you can derive some remarkable results about how gravity really works.
So then you can kind of get to some of those laws because you experience the same thing in different places, and in that experience, then you can kind of come to some of the laws that that make up physics.
Exactly right. Here's one thing, we know exactly how it works. Here's another thing, we don't really know exactly how it works. But if we postulate that they're equivalent, that's what Einstein did, then all of a sudden you learn something really new and fundamental about gravity. And that is the basis for everything we understand about how gravity really works in the universe. And so when people start talking in sci-fi about wormholes and black holes and things like that, all of that ultimately stems from this very basic assumption by Einstein.
Okay, and we have somebody calling in, William from Boyerton, Pennsylvania. You're on the line. Welcome to Radio Times.
Hello, good morning. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Doctor.
Yes.
I don't think that the future can be predicted for the following reason. We live in a universe of infinitesimal randomness. And infinitesimal randomness, which is always in motion and continually repositioning over time, never repeats its structure ever again. So if we know it's not going to be what it was, then we have no idea what it's going to be.
So I can address this in a couple of ways, if you don't mind. So there's two different scales. So the scale that our caller is referring to is the microscopic scale, is the quantum mechanical scale. There's a really, it turns out, on the atomic scale and very, very small, you have fundamental randomness that shows up in the universe. And you're absolutely correct that we can't predict exactly how things are going to play out. Although one of the great triumphs of the early 20th century was, while we can't predict individual events, we can predict their probabilities. And that has been borne out by countless experiments. But then there is a sense in which we can certainly predict macroscopic behavior, things on the human scale and larger. So, you know, if you and I are in our backyard and I throw you the ball, your brain, even if you don't want to do this on pen and paper, your brain can predict the trajectory of that ball. It's doing a physics problem right there in your head, and you know where to stand, you know where to put your hand and to catch it. That is your brain doing a physics problem and, in essence, predicting the future and predicting it quite accurately. I just let go of a ball. You know exactly what's going to happen. It's going to fall. It's going to fall to the ground. We can, of course, predict things in a more detailed way and more complicated scenarios. But there's a big component where, yeah, we are, in fact, predicting the future.
We're talking about physics, and we're going to get into some squishy things here that we might not all understand, but we're going to try to keep the conversation at a level that those of us who are non-scientists can understand. If you have questions, give us a call. The phone number is 1-888-345-9499. We're talking with Dave Goldberg. He's a professor at Drexel University, and he has written the book called The Universe in the Rearview Mirror, and he has a little bit of a knack here of explaining the complicated to those of us who might not understand it. Give us a call, 888-345-9499. Also, you can send an email to radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. We'll be back after a break.
The Meadowbrook School, located in Abington Township, supports WHYY and is an independent, small-by-design elementary school for children in grades preschool through 6th. Education at Meadowbrook emphasizes a lifelong love of learning, encourages both creative and critical thinking, expands a sense of integrity, and inspires students to make a positive difference. To learn more, there is a Meadowbrook Open House on Sunday, January 26th from 1 to 3 p.m. Registration at themeadowbrookschool.org.
Even the cleanest of homes can sometimes be visited by the contemptible cockroach. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next You Bet Your Garden, we'll reveal the non-toxic ways to get rid of or prevent this odious invader. Plus, answers to all your growing questions. That's You Bet Your Garden, Saturday morning at 11, right here on WHYY-FM.
Yeah. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Next time on Here and Now...
Hello, Raleigh!
President Obama won North Carolina in 2008, but Mitt Romney took it in 2012. We'll visit the battleground state. Is it red, blue, or purple? That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times. I'm Jeff Brady in for Marty Moscowane. We're talking with Dave Goldberg. He's a physics professor at Drexel and writes the Ask a Physicist column at io9.com. You can join the conversation at 1-888-345-9499. During the first segment, you mentioned the mathematician Emmy Noether. And you said that if you were going to form a fantasy physics league, sort of like a fantasy football league, I guess, that you would pick mathematician Emmy Noether. Tell us a bit about her.
So I think it's a disservice to talk about her without mentioning a little bit about her biography, because, I mean, she really is a just wonderful example of somebody who overcame tremendous adversity from inside the academic community to rise to incredible prominence. But even now, she's a figure who, within physics, is relatively unknown. So Noether was an almost exact contemporary of Einstein. She was a very gifted student in high school, wanted to go on and pursue mathematics in college. Very reasonable profession, given that her father was a mathematics professor. Her father,
this was
Max,
in Germany?
This was in what is now Germany. It was in, I believe, Bavaria at the time. And basically, even though she had all these wonderful test scores, she was not allowed to enroll as a mathematics major. And so she was very determined. She was encouraged basically to be a language tutor. She was gifted in languages as well. But she said, no, I'm going to sit in on all the classes and basically audit them and then sit in on the finals and graduate, which is exactly what she
clearly
did.
A person who just wanted to learn.
Very motivated, not just learn, but produce remarkable work. I mean, it was a decade or more after she got her PhD before she got even the first paycheck. So she was then able to finally enroll as a PhD student, got her PhD in mathematics, and then for 4 or 5 years did essentially nothing. I mean, she worked. She worked and produced some tremendous results, but she wasn't able to get an appointment anywhere. She basically taught for her father every now and again, produced some remarkable work on mathematics, but could not get an appointment despite her advanced ability until 1915. And so Einstein came along. He came up with his theory of general relativity. And general relativity, I mentioned its relationship to symmetry in the first segment, the idea that gravity and acceleration sort of feel the same, and Einstein said that they are the same. And people recognized there must be some relationship between symmetry and how gravity worked. And people were very, very excited about the theory. So what happened was the mathematician David Hilbert, who was a tremendous advocate for Noether throughout her career, brought her to Göttingen University in what normally would have been a very esteemed visiting professorship, but which the faculty at Göttingen basically said, no, she can visit, but we're not going to give her a paycheck or a title or anything like that. And there's a famous line by Hilbert where he's like, I don't see that her sex has anything to do with her qualifications. We're running a university here, not a bathhouse. So,
wow.
So you know, he continuously tried to get her an appointment. It wasn't for another, I think, 8 years until after she arrived before he got her anything official. But almost immediately upon arriving at Göttingen, Noether came up with what is known as Noether's theorem, what now is known as Noether's theorem, or sometimes Noether's first theorem. And it basically says all of these symmetries that we see in the universe, between space and time and reflections, all the things like that, all of them form the basis. If there's a symmetry, there's also what's called a conservation law. And physicists love conservation laws. If our theme is physics predicts the future, conservation laws are a simple way to do it. And I guess the simplest example of a conservation law works with money. You have $50 in your wallet, you go to dinner, it costs you 20. There's still $50 flying out there, just 30 in your wallet, and then the restaurant has 20.
Okay.
And if you know that you've paid 20, you don't need to count what's left in your wallet. You know what you started with, and you know that all the totals have to add up. So Noether recognized that there's all these conserved quantities in the universe, and she related every single one that we knew at the time, and people have continued doing this since, to conserved quantities. So, for example, conservation of charge, electric charge, can be neither created nor destroyed. Momentum, I mentioned earlier, that objects in motion stay in motion, objects at rest stay in rest. Conservation of energy. And then her work, her theorem, was used basically as the foundation for all of modern physics. We now live in a world in which there are four fundamental forces that we know of. Those seem to they seem to describe everything. And our theory, what's known as the standard model of physics, is just built on Noether's edifice of her theorem, where she says, you know, here's how you compute everything. Give me a symmetry, and I'll give you something that's conserved. And so when you hear about very fancy theories like supersymmetry, people are proposing at the Large Hadron Collider is supposed to be a test for this idea called supersymmetry, among other things. That is fundamentally built on Noether's work about symmetry.
So very important, and yet she's not mentioned in any of the textbooks. You teach an introductory physics course at Drexel, and you say she's not mentioned in textbooks.
She is mentioned in very, very few or very, very briefly. And, I mean, there's a couple of reasons for that. First, of course, there is the fact that she was treated very, very poorly in her time, largely because she was a woman, locally, partly because she was a pacifist.
You say locally, she has a Pennsylvania connection, right?
Oh, she does. She was, I meant locally in her early life.
Oh, okay.
But she finished her career at Bryn Mawr, where unfortunately she passed away about 18 months after arriving due to complications due to cancer. And so that, a shortened life also, I think, played some role. But there's, so she was definitely robbed of the credit that she deserves, I think, in the popular imagining. But there's another aspect to it as well. And I think this connects to, this connects to the issue about popular writing and science, which is that Noether's papers are very, very difficult to read for a non-expert, for a non-expert in her specific disciplines in mathematics. So, and I mentioned there's sort of some parallels to Einstein. They were contemporaries. Einstein also had some difficulty getting appointments early in his career until he made his great discoveries in 1905. But one of the reasons that Einstein is such a household name, and I think became so well known early on, is that his papers are incredibly readable. You know, this is readable by physics paper standards. But the idea, I mean, clearly there are also equations, but he has this idea. He's like, look, I've got this clever idea. Let me walk you through it. And that's exactly what he does. Noether basically in her papers sort of takes the attitude like, look, we're all mathematical experts here. Here are some equations. Good luck.
Okay. So Emmy Noether, a person important to the physics world. I didn't know her name before a week ago, but now a lot more people do. Let's go to the telephones. We have Jeff in Plymouth Meeting. You're on the air with Dave Goldberg. He's a physics professor at Drexel University. And what is your question?
Yeah, my question was something about kind of the limits of science. You know, I've always operated under the conceit that if it's something that we can think about, just because we can't explain it today doesn't mean that science can't eventually explain it. And I know this is at odds with some people who think that there's some things about the universe that are just unexplainable, and they want to insert all kinds of other things into that. I can't explain that part, but I'd just be curious as to your thoughts about, you know, what do you think the limits of science are? Like, how far can science go to explain everything?
That's an excellent question. So there's limits of science in almost every direction you can consider. So implied in your question, at least, one of the limits of science is where did the universe come from, for example? Where did we fundamentally come from? And there's two different ways of answering that include the phrase, I don't know. I don't know what happened in the very, very beginning of the universe. Physics right now, the limits of even speculation, just to give you an idea, basically terminate around 10 to the minus 43. That's 0.00043 zeros 1 second after the Big Bang. Incredibly small amount of time. But we're not at the position where we can say anything about what actually happened at the instant of the Big Bang. And so right now, there's a limit of science where we don't know where that comes from. And it may, in fact, be the case that we never know what happened before that. People have ideas, and they may or may not be testable. Part of the problem is that at the very, very instant of the Big Bang, the temperatures were just incredibly high. The energies were incredibly high. And so in order to understand them, we need to build experiments. And basically, the earlier you go, the hotter the universe was, the bigger and higher energy of the experiments we need to measure. So to sort of put it in perspective, the Large Hadron Collider in Switzerland and France can get up to the energies that were basically prevalent around 10 to the minus 12 seconds after the Big Bang. Very, very, you know, like incredibly short period mm-hmm. of time, but still many, many, many orders of magnitude further, later than what we're talking about. So to even probe some of these questions, we need to build accelerators the size of the solar system. So there's those sorts of limits where we don't know the answer now, and we don't know if we'll know the answer. And then there are other limits of science that come from our limited perspective. So there's the fact that we can only see so far. We only have the one universe to experiment with, and we have a horizon in our universe. And anything that's beyond that, we can't even detect. So there are lots of limits to what we can say right now. I'm not willing to say what will the final limit of science be, because we haven't reached it. We certainly have questions that we don't yet know the answer to, but we believe are answerable on the trajectories that we're currently working on.
We're talking with Dave Goldberg. He's a physics professor at Drexel University, and we have a lot of people calling in with questions, a lot of people interested about what you know and your ability to explain it. We have Larry calling from Old City, and you have a question, I guess, about string theory.
Hello?
Yes, Larry, you're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
What I've always wanted to know about was string theory. And I was wondering if you could explain string theory for dummies, because I'm a real dummy when it comes to this stuff. But I've heard about
I'm
it.
I'm with
I
you, Larry.
Well,
I also have one other thing. Are
okay, let's stick with that first question first here, if we could. Just sort of a string theory for dummies.
So in a very real sense, I'm not the best person to ask about this, because I am not a big believer in string theory.
Okay.
String theory posits a number of things. It basically says, you know, we live in a three-dimensional universe, height, width, depth, and then plus time. And string theory says there's lots of what are called small dimensions where basically you can't really even move in them, because kind of like a Pac-Man world, you know, you go out one side, you come back the other. But the scales are much, much smaller even than an atom. And it turns out that all the big structures that we see, or relatively big structures like electrons and things like that, they're just vibrations in that very, very small dimensional universe. The problem with string theory, so that's the 10 second description of it. There are a lot of problems with string theory. String theory was introduced about 30 odd years ago, and the problem is that it's supported by a number of very, very clever people. But the problem is that in order to test it, you need to get up to energies far, far beyond what we ever are going to be able to probe. Mm. I think I may have mentioned, you know, accelerators the size of the entire solar system, for example, as opposed to ones that are a few kilometers across, which to us now are hugely expensive, billions of dollar experiments. There's no way we're going to be able to test that. And string theory has sort of failed in some sense, because they haven't produced predictions that you can then test. So one of the hallmarks of science versus not science is that science, typically, you want to be able to say, if you do this experiment and you do not get such and such a result, I will have to admit that I'm wrong. If I take a ball and I let it go and it flies up in the air, my theory of gravity is incorrect. Right. I mean, provided we're not cheating, there's no rocket ball or something
right.
like that. But it's called falsifiability. And string theory doesn't have any predictions like that. So, you know, it's interesting because, you know, we're talking about the frontiers of science, but it may not be the frontiers of science because it may not be science in the sense of being something that's testable.
We just don't know yet. I know I have questions about black holes, and we have Bob from Newark, Delaware on the telephone, and he has a question about black holes. But first, before we go to Bob, maybe you could explain what is a black hole, just simply.
Okay, I'm going to use my spooky voice here because that's required. That's required for a black hole. So the idea of a black hole is it is an object whose gravity is so strong that nothing can escape, not even light. I don't know if our producer would put in the echo voice, but I'm really hoping. So this is the fate of very massive stars, we believe, and there seems to be black holes at the center of our galaxy. But they're very, very strong gravitational fields, and they seem to be real.
Okay, so Bob from Newark, Delaware, you have a question about black holes.
Yes, my question is, I was grandiose, but as you said, it's supposed to be so massive that not even light can escape. But yet, when I often see depictions of black holes, there's often these two beams shooting out of them, which seems to be escaping. Huh. So I was hoping you could provide some knowledge around that.
So normally, if you said something about an artist's conception, I'd say, well, the artist just has it wrong. But not in this case. So you're right that nothing escapes from black holes, or technically, that black holes will evaporate, but given quadrillions of years, but that's not what we're talking about here. But black holes typically don't exist in isolation. They have strong gravitational fields, and so what happens is that gas and dust and other stuff falls onto them. But as those things get closer and closer and closer to the black hole, they go closer and closer to the speed of light. And those become very, very energetic. They create friction. And kind of like when you take your hands and you rub them together and it creates heat, it creates light, it creates heat, it creates radiation. And those objects are known as quasars, quasi-stellar objects. So the light you're seeing is not from the black hole itself. It's from the area outside of the black hole of the stuff that's falling into it.
So the law still stands.
That law still stands.
Okay, it's just you're seeing the something else. We're talking with Dave Goldberg. He's a professor in the physics department at Drexel University. And what do you think is a big misconception about black holes? Just very quickly here.
So probably the biggest misconception about a black hole is what would happen if, say, our sun turned into one.
Okay.
So people think, you know, black holes are these sort of like unstoppable killing machines, that if there's a black hole around, you're just going to fall into it and die. But the reality is that far away from a black hole, the gravity behaves just like gravity from anything else. So if all of a sudden our sun were turned into a black hole, nothing would happen. Well, I mean, we'd get cold, of course, because it's not giving off light, as we say. But we'd keep orbiting exactly as we did before, just as a giant ice ball. So we wouldn't fall in.
All right. That's Dave Goldberg. He's a professor in the physics department at Drexel University. He wrote the book, The Universe in the Rearview Mirror. If you have a question or comment, I know we're getting into some technical stuff here, but any question is welcome. Trust me, I have a lot of silly ones written down here. So feel free to call in. The number is 888-345-9499. Also, the email is radiotimes@whyy.org. We'll be back after a break.
Supporting WHYY, Opera Philadelphia presents Ina Demar, Fountain of Tears, the Grammy Award-winning opera about the life and death of Federico Garcia Lorca. This Spanish production makes its only U.S. appearance in Philadelphia and features flamenco dancing by the Antonio Gades Company. Ina Demar is a celebration of an artist's struggle for love and free expression. Ina Demar at the Academy of Music from February 7th through 16th. Tickets and information at operaphila.org or by phone at 215-893-1018.
Four pirates!
The film Captain Phillips, about a hostage drama at sea, is nominated for an Academy Award for Best Picture and is now out on DVD. On the next Fresh Air, we hear from the film's star, Tom Hanks, and its director, Paul Greengrass. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Mm-hmm.
The friends of Hillary would more than fill a Lincoln bedroom.
The Clintons have been collecting friends, advisors, people who feel invested in her future for 40 years. But it also creates a lot of not knowing where you stand.
Do longtime Clinton loyalists gum up what looks like a well-oiled 2016 campaign machine? What to do about the FOH factor next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Jeff Brady in for Marty Moskowain. We're talking about physics with Drexel Professor Dave Goldberg, and we're going to go to some phone calls here. Lots of people interested in talking about physics, and we're going to go to Jack in Piper'sville in just a minute here. Actually, we're going to go to Don in Center City. Don, you're on the air. Welcome to Radio Times.
Great. How you doing, Mr. Goldberg?
Good.
You can put these shows on all the time, and you'll get thousands of calls because people can ask basic questions and get them explained so rudimentary. It's unbelievable. I love it, and I appreciate you guys. And I have a question. I'll tell you how my introduction into physics came. Okay. I was at the University of Colorado, and I read the school newspaper every day, and I was so hungry and so poor, I would read where there's refreshments being served after symposiums. And the physics department always had symposiums with refreshments, and no one ever showed up. So I got to eat, like, for free.
That's what graduate students do as well.
Yeah. So if you go to the social works department, hundreds of people showed up at the
top. You know, okay, so you have a question?
Writing books.
You have a question,
and
Don?
My question is, why is everything circular in space? I mean, why are the planets, and when we're looking for other planets, and why is everything circular? What is that equation that makes everything circular?
Is everything circular?
Well, I mean, a lot of things are very close to circular or roughly spherical. I mean, certainly our Earth is. And a big part of that is that it is it's spinning. Like, that's one of the things that causes it to sort of bulge out. It actually makes it a little bit not circular. But, I mean, the question sort of points to something else, which is, there is sort of a fundamental symmetry in the universe and the laws of physics that are related to circularity, which is that gravity is the same in all directions. So you could think of that as a circular symmetry. If I go in one direction, I go in another direction, the strength of gravity is all the same. And, you know, I want to sort of jump off this question a little bit, which is to say, early on, you know, the assumption was because circles are such beautifully symmetric objects, you had people like Aristotle assuming that the planets must orbit around, and he assumed the planets orbited around the Earth, that they must orbit around the Earth in a perfect circle.
Mm.
And of course, you know, we observe things that seem to have a circular shape. I mean, typically, again, the circularity just comes from the fact that you've got things that are spinning, and that tends to circularize them. And in our solar system, the orbits tend to be largely circular because if they weren't, things would hit one another. And, you know, in circles, they can nest very nicely and not collide. But Aristotle was wrong, and he was wrong, and he was shown to be wrong by Johannes Kepler in 1610. And when Kepler came up with his laws of motion, he said, no. Kepler and ultimately Newton showed how this worked. He said, no, it's not that the orbits are exactly circular, just like the Earth isn't exactly circular. It's that the laws of physics are circular. So if you start off with the gravity going from the sun equally in all directions, you get these elliptical orbits that Kepler found. So there are things that kind of look circular, and it turns out that they're based on something even more fundamental that has an even more perfect symmetry to them.
So Don got interested in physics by food, it sounds like. But how did you get interested in physics?
Well, first of all, I want to comment on Don's access to physics, because I want to put in a pitch for something that shows up all around Philadelphia and wherever you happen to be located, which is most universities will have something like a public observing night. There aren't usually refreshments, I'm sorry. But, but if you are sort of interested in science in general, those things are, including Drexel has one of these once a month, I believe the first Wednesday of the month.
Mm.
You can go up there, you can look at the stars, and you can talk to physics professors, graduate students, who are more than happy while you're waiting in line in the cold to tell you all about anything you'd been curious about. So I want to make a pitch for that before we get into that. But I came from sort of a science background myself. My father was ABD, all but dissertation, in physical chemistry. started me at a very early age talking about mathematics, history of science, that sort of thing. But honestly, a big part of it for me was I had great high school teachers, and I had I started reading books like A Brief History of Time. That was the first one I remember really engaging with. So this is Hawking's famous book.
I saw on your website, on the Drexel University website, you said you've done a lot of work on popularization. That's important to you. What does that mean, and why is it important to you?
Well, I think it's important because so popularization includes, of course, conversations like this. It includes writing books, my Ask a Physicist column, and even just responding to emails from people who have questions about the universe. So a big part of it is we work in our labs, we come up with discoveries. Some of them are esoteric. Occasionally, some of them are groundbreaking. But the sort of future march of science doesn't mean as much if the public isn't participating in it, if they don't know what it is we know about the universe. And quite frankly, in a purely greedy respect, if they're not excited enough about it to actually feel that society should be in a position to support the sciences. So, you know, I see that as part of our core mission. I want people to know what it is we're doing, what it is we know, without having to get an advanced degree in it.
I want to talk in a few minutes about this encouraging young people to pursue science, too. But first, let's go back to the telephone. So we have Jack from Piper'sville, and you have a question for Dave Goldberg, Jack?
Yes, I do. I have a question for Dr. Goldberg. I've always been taught that there's no such thing as perpetual motion, and yet the Earth turns perpetually and revolves around the sun perpetually. And does this lack of perpetual motion just apply to the Earth? But there are forces in space, that, you know, gravitational pulls here and there, and you would know more about than I, but perhaps you could comment on that.
So you picked a couple of very interesting examples. So you're absolutely correct. I want to make sure we hit that right away, that there is no such thing as perpetual motion. All things tend to disorder. It's called the second law of thermodynamics. And it sounds very dire. It means that the ultimate fate of the universe, as far as we understand it, is that the universe will be filled with a tepid pool of photons, and that you will have been swallowed up by a black hole and spit out as very low energy light. So I'm sorry about that. That's a very low energy state. But even if we talk about things like the Earth orbiting, the Earth rotating, for example, you say, you know, we get up every day, the Earth just keeps spinning, same every day. It's not. We are actually slowing down, in large part because of the interaction of the moon. So the moon goes, you've heard of the tides. The tides basically produce a friction as they rise and fall. And as a result, the Earth is slowing down. Likewise, the Earth going around the sun, you know, as we continue to go around the sun is changing. The sun is giving off light. It's becoming very, very it's giving off light and actually a little bit of solar wind as well, and it's getting lighter. So even our motion around the sun isn't permanent. We are human beings who last, if we're lucky, 100 years, and these things change on scales of billions of years, and so we just think that they're constant, but they're not.
I want to get back to this the science education, and there seems to be a lot of focus encouraging young people to study science right now, and I guess often to me it seems like the purpose is ensure that young person is employable, you know, get an engineering degree and you'll always have a job in the world as it exists now. I wonder if you agree with that assessment, and if so, what do you think about that?
Well, I mean, it is absolutely the case. I don't want to understate this case, that it is very, very important to have employable skills, that mathematics, technical ability, along with the ability to express yourself and write. I mean, these are a complete set of skills that you want to have as a human being, regardless of whether it makes you employable. There is absolutely, in this country, need for people who can create innovative technologies, engineering and technology. And there's an acronym for this sort of education. It's called STEM, Science, Technology, Engineering, and Math. There's a danger, though. So, you know, I absolutely think it's great to get lots of people involved in this, especially, I will say, young women. You know, it's not an accident that, no, there's a hero in my book. I have two small daughters at home, the one who's capable of speech. You know, we talk about science all the time. But I do to some degree want to separate out the science and math part of STEM from the technology and engineering. Hmm. The technology and engineering is sort of sold on the idea that we're going to create technologies for the next generation, and this will make you employable. And, well, if there's any prospective college students or graduate students listening out there, I do want to make the case that there are very good careers in science and math. The goals of basic science, basic math, are different. They're furthering our knowledge as a species. In some sense, I feel like we make common cause with the arts in that way.
Sure.
We're trying to understand where we are, where we came from, where we're going, and make sense of that all. So I think that there's two different sort of big goals in all of this, but having at an elementary and middle school and even high school level a sort of good background in science and math basically opens up a huge number of doors, whichever path you decide to follow, even if it ends up not being in science at all.
So you want the next generation of engineers and scientists, but you also want the next Emmy Noether.
I want the next Emmy Noether, or I want the next novelist who doesn't go into science or math or engineering at all, but is numerate, has the ability to understand mathematical arguments. I mean, this is important for members of society as a whole.
Sure. Let's go back to the telephone. We have Mark from Ballachinwood. You're on the air with Dave Goldberg. What's your question?
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I had a real quick question about how sure we are that the laws of physics billions and billions of light years away from Earth are the same as the laws of physics that we can test here on Earth experimentally. And the reason why I ask is because there's been a lot of talk about dark matter and dark energy trying to explain some of the motions of the galaxies that are billions and billions of light years away from Earth. And it seems to me that the whole creation of dark matter and dark energy subject or concept smacks of the ether story that had in the late 1800s before Einstein disproved that, did away with the necessary notion of ether to transmit light. And so I guess so it seems to me that dark energy and dark matter is just a way for us to explain how the motions of those stars distant from us, trying to bend the laws of physics, if you will, that we view here on Earth to fit the billions and billions of light years away. So
Thank you, Mark. So this idea, are we sure that the laws of physics as they exist here are the same when they're very, very far away from us?
So Mark's question, he actually has two excellent questions. One is, why do we believe in dark matter and dark energy? And why don't I say a few words about what those are. So our standard picture of cosmology right now is that basically, number one, there are two components of the universe that we don't understand terribly well. One is called dark matter, and it's basically this material. It has mass, and it makes up most of the mass of galaxies. And indeed, it makes up about five times the amount of mass in the universe as ordinary stuff. The only thing is, we can't see it. Now, it's not that strange that we can't see things. We can't see lots of particles that we know to exist. Some of them, like neutrons, for example, took a long time because they don't have electric charge and they're difficult to detect. And then the other component you mentioned was called dark energy. And dark energy was actually the subject of essentially the 2011 Nobel Prize. And it's this substance, if you want to think of it that way, that causes the universe to accelerate, not just expand, but accelerate in its expansion. And so why are we so sure that these things exist? They were first introduced, dark matter in particular, was first introduced because it seemed like there wasn't enough gravity, mass in galaxies to keep galaxies together without flying apart because of their rotation. And this was postulated in the 1920s and then again in the 1970s for various systems. And by the way, it isn't just distant galaxies we need to worry about. Our own galaxy wouldn't be held together except from dark matter. So this is a very useful tool, but I think one thing you need to keep in mind, the caller and anybody else who's worried about this sort of thing, is we don't introduce dark matter and dark energy just to explain this one phenomenon. It turns out that there's countless experiments, things like measurements of distant supernovae, measurements and very, very detailed measurements of the most distant light from right after the Big Bang that would totally not make any sense unless we have this standard picture of cosmology. So it's not just that we say these things exist, but we quantify them in very precise ways. We would love to know exactly where they come from, and we are working on it.
Okay, we're going to take one last telephone call from John in Mannheim, Pennsylvania. Welcome to Radio Times. You're on with Dave Goldberg.
Yeah, hi. Professor Goldberg, I just wanted to get your idea on space travel, the human concept of space travel, time travel, and dimensions in relation to black hole theory you had mentioned, and how extraterrestrials would travel the universe. Do they travel through dimensions? Do they go through black holes? So on and so on.
And you got about a minute.
I've got about a minute. So time travel, of course, we are already doing, just in the most boring way imaginable, at 1 second per second. Unfortunately, it seems like most of the models that we've come up with for sort of time machines seem to be precluded by physical laws. I'm not going to say that with 100% certainty, but over the last few years, I've become much more skeptical that it's even theoretically possible. As far as space travel, Einstein seems to be basically right on the count that we're limited by the speed of light. There is one cool effect, though, and this might be the one that aliens would exploit, which is that as you get closer and closer to the speed of light, time appears to slow down for you, which means that you can go distances that are many, many more, many, many light years in what seems like a human lifetime. So there's some good news there.
A lot of questions and a lot of people interested in asking you questions. Dave Goldberg's book, each chapter, he essentially asks and answers a question, very helpful in that matter. Thank you so much. Dave Goldberg is a professor in the physics department at Drexel University, and his book, The Universe in the Rearview Mirror, is out now. Thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
If you'd like to learn more about this program, go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You'll find links to our Twitter handle, our Facebook feed is there, and there's information on podcasts, where to find us on satellite radio, archives, email contact information, and more. The engineer today is Bob Alls. The producers of Radio Times are Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Jeff Brady, filling in for Marty Moscowane.